Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 76, where Pedro, Greta, Tom, and Sam are discussing Charles Perrow's article, A Framework for the Comparative Analysis of Organizations, published in the American Sociological Review in 1967. If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
You know, Pepper's note about how Perrow and his fellow dinner table partners didn't win the paradigm war. I'm just thinking about when you go back to the contingency theory scholars, people identifying with that perspective, they make us aware that we have to specify the worlds we're studying. And I feel like, you know, really good papers do specify that. For instance, when you think about, you know, Betsky's work on the film crews, other papers studying, you know, for instance, thinking about Natalia Vina's work on IT outsourcing, perhaps we found more nuanced ways to specify the worlds we're studying. You know, if you look at inductive research, we do develop theoretical insights from that setting. But then, you know, always the theoretical challenge in terms of your contributions is to see, like, can you move beyond your setting to come to more abstract, higher level insights in a way, if that's right wording. You know, I was making a note when Pedro said, like, you know, perhaps certain finds may apply to different conditions and thinking about, you know, the boundary conditions of our work. And when you look at the end of a paper, for instance, think about a paper published in AMJ or, you know, Journal of Management Studies or whatnot, you know, we always have like this final paragraph on limitations and further research. We always don't like to write that paragraph because you feel like if you do it too well, then the reviewer will reject your paper. You know, Perrow and Woodward and others, they, you know, the Aston School, they say, like, we should be mindful that our findings derive from the worlds we studied. And there might be elements that apply to other worlds. That's also what Perrow writes, that, you know, like a church and what did he say? Like, an organization in a different industry might have more in common than two hospitals. In a way, it's a reminder there. But then also thinking about that, what was bugging me about the implications for case study research? And, you know, I'm passionate about that. I love to do case study research, and I really like to do multiple cases because often when you study one thing in one setting and then study it in another, you realize the differences and you think, like, this is what explains that difference. And it's only by comparison. And, you know, the comparative method, it's such an essence of science. But then one way to summarize Perrow is, you know, why do comparison? Because every organization is different. I feel like what I want to have after reading this paper and being passionate about case study research is to know, okay, on what characteristics should I look at to say, okay, these cases can be comparable. And I feel like that's something where we can move further as a field to say, like, okay, Let's see if we can come up with some standards there. Because at the moment, we'll say, you know, like, based upon these characteristics, they're more or less similar. So, and then it's up to the reviewer to evaluate. But who decides on what criteria the reviewer evaluates? I'm not sure.
I'd like to tackle one part of what you're talking about, because when you talk about paradigm war, that sort of gets into the metaphor I was using before about gravity. There's tendencies sort of inherent in, or that's articulated, that says that there are certain things that organizations will naturally prefer, such that, for example, judging an academic's performance becomes routine, becomes measurable and easily analyzable. But it also kind of signals a certain amount of practical interference. When we're talking about, as scientists trying to build abstract knowledge to understand better about organizations, gravity pulls us a different direction. What's the type of a study, or what's the type of an organization paradigm or what have you, that will get the most attention? That's going to be the things that are be a bit more efficient, a bit more practical, those types of characteristics. So, for example, when we're talking about trying to take the results of something like this, what this paper is showing, and say that, you know, we want to try to encourage the organization to become innovative, that gravity flow that's sort of hidden here, especially in an organization that's deeply embedded in the routine, we've got to do a lot of work to try to get the organization to think differently about itself. But then another factor comes in when we have people come in with models or with ideas or what have you that's worked in other places, et cetera, et cetera. If it runs afoul of the way that the organization sees itself or the leaders of the organization see it, it's going to be somewhat rejected. And if the whole practical sphere has its gravity headed towards the routine, then it's going to have a lot more difficulty, things that are going to be a bit novel or different. So to use the gravity metaphor one more time, we have to overcome a lot of G-forces in order to get from the routine to the non-routine. And this is kind of like in our in the case of academia, when we say that things have been routinized, I mean certain types of studies, certain ways of measuring things have been routinized such that if we're going to introduce something novel, G-forces come in the form of every single review, the way in which we do grants and all of these sorts of things that offer opportunities to get in the way. Part of the question becomes, how do you introduce novelty? How do you take what Perot wrote in terms of, let's see, I'm going to start with raw material. What is the, what's the analog here? Theoretical contribution is something that is one that everybody can latch onto, that would conform to some sort of a central idea of what a reviewer looks for. Few exceptions, I would interpret as within the bounds of a particular knowledge base, not particularly boundary spanning. You can sort of apply this to different sorts of production. In some way, the abstract knowledge that we develop has to become practical or has to be useful to somebody.
Turning the light onto ourselves. I love this exercise, right? Because sometimes in science we say the whole world moves this way, but what about where we stand? So how does it apply to where we stand? And I like your push, but as I understand, the technology or the organization of academic work is very far from a Tayloristic one in which efficiency and so on is paramount. Because unlike such a setting, there is no clarity to what is the output, right? Exactly what Samantha was saying in the last part. What is the work to be done? What is the collective agreement that we should be producing? And it's interesting that you raises that, because in the 60s and 70s in organizational theory, people have argued that there was a broader, maybe because the field was less specialized, there was more of a broader shared sense of collective work. The attention was towards understanding the function of organization, creating frameworks, trying to understand the influence of structure, understanding contingencies. There was a lot of debate about what is the kind of metric that you should use, how does these findings apply to different contexts and industries. And Aston has studied not only across industries, but across the world even. So this was a more of a shared work in one we could describe in such a way, right? But it has not become like that in the past decades and has become more of a motley crew, more of a rock band, more like, you know, sometimes I was listening to a podcast some days ago about how it was in Stevie Nicks. What is the name of that band that Stevie Nicks was in? Flatwood Mac. How was the structure and the organization of the work in Flatwood Mac? And everyone was writing their songs and fighting and all that and trying to get their songs on the CD. It's a little bit like what looks like in academia, right? There is no sense of what is the shared output and everyone is running different ways. So I think that that's exactly the issue that creates some of these things, that there is no common shared idea that what would be the standard tools and outputs through which we should do our work. And therefore, the pure abstract has been the reigning goal, you know, the idea that we should try to not just go beyond our case, but try to speak about organizations in general, because In parallel to that, unlike in the continuous theory times, the connection to practice has been eroded, right? The concern for saying something that was concrete and relevant to practice has become less and less of a threshold and a requirement. So with decentralization galore, multiple goals, and an interest, let's call it like that, for science sake, right? Or understanding for understanding's sake, which can be important, but you know, I'm just describing, but that's what has been the way in which the work is organized has left it where we are, that there is no such similar comparable situation in which we would be trying to do collective work that is organized towards a particular goal. And again, we can argue, as Samantha was saying, whether organizations ever do that, because which work characterizes an organization is not necessarily straightforward. And maybe we should explore a bit this proposition, right?
I think this example of, you know, looking at academia and trying to understand in this kind of framework also get us to discuss something that maybe we haven't discussed a lot, which is the social structure part, which I found a little bit more confusing and less straightforward than the task structure. But I agree with you. But I mean, yeah, if I think it fits perfectly, or I don't know what you guys think, but the work that we do, which is, you know, it values quality, it values innovation, it is non-routine work, it has high discretion, high power for everybody involved, it is flexible and poly-centralized, that more or less seems to fit, it seems to be a good description. And so getting to the social structure, what non-routine work would lead to is having a social structure that is worried about goal identification. I think this gives us kind of an opportunity to jump into the social structure and, you know, what you thought about what the relationship is to the task structure and whether this is clear in Perrow's framework.
I was looking at that. Does that social structure reflect four actual different, is there an implied relationship between the social structure matrix and the task structure matrix, or is that one that is assumed? For a organization that would be in the for the task structure, one that would be formal and centralized, is it connected to the idea that instrumental identity is first and foremost? Is that connection assumed? I would definitely not go there. I have a difficulty making that connection, but I wasn't really sure if that was the connection he was trying to make.
So he does. So all of the 2x2 that we have throughout the paper, that's why I ended up doing like my own, where I just put all of the 2x2s, because they are meant to have a relationship. And so for example, the non-routine work, for me, it was kind of, you know, understandable and straightforward why that would lead to having a social structure that's concerned with goal identification. But I agree with you, the other ones, for example, instrumental identity or social identity were not so clear to me, like what was the relationship. So that's where I got a bit lost, to be honest.
Well, it's just one of those things where, yeah, you'll divide it into a 2x2. And maybe if you're trying to show a assumed predominance, like I can understand where social identity or communal identity would come in. If you're talking about if the work is craft oriented. Because I think about, like, in Pennsylvania, we have a number of craft brewers, beer brewers. Although I don't know to what extent they really socialize, but they're a community of practice, in effect. They have conferences, they're targeting the same audiences, they do a lot of similar activities. And there is sort of like a social identity that comes with it, you know, that has taken them from what is a craft hobby and has translated it into a vocation, a very passionate vocation for, you know, if you know craft brewers, they're a very passionate group, and they're very proud of their products. Goal identification can be a big part of it too, because a number of them, just because of the nature of business, can't just be nothing but pure brewers, okay? They have to think broader. A lot of craft breweries get into the restaurant business because they can't function solely as a brewery. They've got to have they've got to have a place for people to come and congregate and enjoy the brew, or they have to have a place to sell it or whatever, because it's hard to compete. There's so many craft brewers. Worker task identification, technical satisfactions, furthering the same example, This is where actually I see a lot of innovation among the brewers. They all want to do something just a little bit different and get away from the standard styles and the standard methods and introduce new things without necessarily changing the brand. Yeah, the engineering sort of task, the flexible centralized. So it's still somewhat centralized work, but it's flexible in that they allow themselves some freedom to do things like small batch of a product and put it on the shelf and see if it sells, or do things specific for occasions or what have you. So I would say that there's could very well be a perception of a dominant relationship, but definitely not to the exclusion. Like its task structure, it's one perhaps to the exclusion of the other three almost, whereas with the social structure, it is one with a little bit of the other three.
What I'm hearing that you all are saying is exactly some of the critique that has been done to contingency theory, right? In that the politics, the strategies, the meanings, the social relations, all that are co-constituting, pushing, reconfiguring all of that. That the way, of course, I do agree that there is configurations, but these configurations do not just come from these necessary links, but links that are imposed by what is common in the industry, how people copy each other, how there is a dominant perception, and so on and so forth, right? The whole organizational theory since contingency has showed that over and over and over, and that's an important insight to remember. So I think it's interesting to think through the elements Perot gives, but also, as you're saying, be aware that the link might not be necessary. And as all you're saying, go identification or the instrumental rationality, whatever, in different, perhaps, levels can be found in all types of organizations, in industries, and so on and so forth, right? Go identification is central for academic work because we like all these other tangible elements. But it's also important in typical bureaucratic organizations. There is interesting papers. There is one that is more or less recent on NASA and how the famous saying, I'm putting the money in the moon, was part to the way even janitors understood their task, you know? So it's important to remind that what a lot of sense making and institutional people have shown is that the symbolic social aspects are much less one-to-one. And with that, I wanted to push us further and think to the extent that some of these elements, such as goals, are in themselves constructed, right? Or as Samantha was saying before, who gets to define what is the central work of the organization? Well, this is up for grabs, right? This, of course, the analyst makes a choice, but people in organizations, they make a choice themselves as well. What is considered central, right? And that's exactly, I think, what organizational theory has tried to show. And that's when, you know, people that do all kinds of more naturalistic ethnographic inquiry tries to show that how these things get defined is through a process, and all kinds of things can happen in the process, right? It's an outcome, not necessarily the start. And of course, for parsimony in this framework, Perot is assuming that it's given and blah, blah, blah. But as we have been able to do more research, we have come to understand the ways in which all of these elements are produced.
Yes, yeah, so that's, I mean, this framework and what Perot's trying to say is basically say technology determines task structure, more or less influences social structure, and then all of that loosely influences the goals. And I think one of the critiques that I could make to this, you know, especially when we think about the goals, is what he's excluding from the framework, which I think can determine goals to a great extent, which is, so one of them we've mentioned, which is the social interactions and the, especially inside the organization and who is redefining either the work or the goals or the structure. And the other one is also the context in which these organizations are existing. So he mentions, you know, social and cultural factors, but there might be others which also might force the organization to have a structure that might, or even goals that might not correspond to the type of work it does, because that's how it manages to survive.
Perhaps related to that, I'm thinking about if we can do a thought experiment. So starting off with Perot's central argument that the work that happens in an organization matters. And thinking about, you know, his context, the context of industrial organizations, or, you know, I'm just thinking about, you know, he studied production factories. Oh, and thinking about, you know, other types of organizations. But what we see now, and you know, COVID has really exponentially moved that transformation forward, is thinking about the way we organize work. And organizations are experimenting with more open models of organizing, like some have called this post-organization. Do we still need the organization in terms of the work? Like, we have platform models where, you know, technology defines the way we interact with each other. We don't need, you know, the walls of an organization to do that. Open innovation, crowdsourcing, you know, working with external talents, so not using full-time employees anymore, but bringing in contractors. You know, there's a lot to criticize on the reading of today, but one of it helps us to reflect on these new or different types of settings and can transport, even though these structures and goals are very different.
Now, this gets into a question that I want to give about the work, and that is the difference between the nature of the work and the character of the work, with the nature of the work being basically it's more timeless, defined aspects of the work that are a bit stable and unchanging, versus the character, which is very context dependent, very dependent on the organization, very dependent on the customer. Because what I sense is in what you're asking is that the nature of the work is itself probably not changing that much. That is, we're still, you know, factories are still producing things. People changing types of organizations that he referred to. They're still, the mission or the purpose of the organizations are still essentially unchanged. So we're only thinking about how, and in a lot of ways, I think it's going to be a while before we really know. Hopefully the vaccine, herd immunity, all whatever it is that's hopefully going to cause us to get into a true post-pandemic phase, whether or not some of these ongoing innovations or ideas will take root. For example, we're going to, you know, potentially have cases where you have a factory that has been producing so much stuff, the demand for the stuff is still the same. The processes, have they really changed? Have they been impacted at all by what's been going on with the pandemic, apart from the added cost of personal protective equipment? Probably not much. The nature of the work is probably going to be the same for those. For those where the character of the work is more dominant, such as in turn, you know, things that are a little bit more social oriented, maybe there'll be some lasting changes. Maybe we'll find ways of, like, for example, some people have said that actually they prefer Zoom meetings over the old round the table meetings because the Zoom meetings are actually more productive. Okay, maybe the character of how we do some of that work, some of the work that used to be face to face, maybe we'll change the way we do some of that and it'll become enduring, but it's still not necessarily going to change the fact that we're doing these meetings and doing work for a particular purpose. Some things may hold, some things may revert back because we'll figure out where the inefficiencies are of doing things remotely. And there's going to, I would imagine that there's going to be a serious push at some point to say, we've got to get back to face-to-face because it was a lot more efficient in getting certain things done. And maybe in the process of doing so, we'll eliminate the old inefficiencies.
So can I give you my summary of what you just said there? And that is the same conclusion that Pro said, that the work that people do matters for how it's being organized?
Yes, that's a good summary. Hopefully that's not an indicator that I got a little bit rambly or something.
Definitely not. I think it still holds. And I think that's, I feel like we're in a day and age that exactly here, because of what we realize is possible, we start to reflect on what is the best way. And I feel like in that sense, perhaps there's a reinvigoration of this debate that's already started. And, you know, perhaps it didn't win the paradigm war at the time, but it brings in relevancy again to understand the questions that a lot of companies are struggling with nowadays. Thinking about, you know, like in my university, I learned we just have a new ways of working program set up to think about, okay, how can we come to more blended models? where some people will be on site, some will be remote. And I feel like these are questions that a lot, if not all, organizations are struggling with.
Yeah, well, there's some other things, though, that are going to become part of this new character of the work, too, because obviously the pandemic has had a very serious negative effect on a lot of organizations who now have had to shutter. So some of the things that's also going to come out of this, regardless of which direction it goes, is what's going to happen with insurance? What's going to happen with administration? What's going to happen with liability? What's going to happen with some of the other things that are not part of the central task of the organization, but are socially, legally, politically, or policy-wise, regulatory, going to become necessities for the organization to exist and to function. Just the personal protective equipment alone. You know, I don't know that we're going to be able to go necessarily back to a point where it would not be required. There will be expectations. Even if it is not required, there's going to be additional precautions, which will cost money. And that is going to influence the way that, you know, organizations operate. Some of this is going to be very good because some organizations were operating in rather unsafe, unhealthy, improper manners for the sake of efficiency. So there's going to be some good change from it. But the organizations and all are going to have to wrestle with this. And how much is it going to impinge upon their ability to function efficiently? That's a question.
So it's interesting that in a way what you're saying is that the social, legal, political, regulatory aspects are going to shift, right? And then you're going to require understanding. And in a way, Perot, and I am deducing here, Perot had to bracket all this social dimension of organizations, right? Because he was writing in the American Sociological Review and trying to write in terms that would start the conversation in a different way, that would be beyond, we can just explain that through social relations, or this is just, you know, the only relevant questions are the ones about alienation or the work process, whatever, right? Let's try to think of organization as they are organized as relevant and an object of inquiry in itself. As time passed, we have expanded our understanding and have come to realize that organisms are, of course, social objects, you know, they're social phenomena that exist in the social fabric. And it's interesting your point because, in a way, some of the apocalyptic discussion in terms of the world is changing and, you know, platforms are reconfiguring everything, sometimes miss all of that, right? And I think the pandemic brought our attention back. That is not just because we can do things like Zoom, that there is a revolutionary thing, right? It is that the context in which we work has shifted to the point that we don't know how the laws are going to apply in liability and so on, right? These are hidden aspects that in the whole technology-oriented discussion sometimes get missed. So it's important, I think, to highlight them. The other one I was thinking, as Greta was talking, what is a thought experiment? Meaning how the framework that Perot has gifted us can help us think of what is happening. And I think that the wisdom of trying to go beyond what is tangible in a way and getting to these fundamentals, task uncertainty, the social structure, the goals, whatever. And we talked about, yes, of course, the links that Perot is assuming are not necessarily the ones that we have seen and so on. But these fundamentals still apply. They're still valuable vocabulary to think exactly in platforms. You know, what kind of tasks can be outsourced in a particular way in a digital space, right? Or what kind of decomposability of a complex system is required so you can have people to collaborate without necessarily having a total understanding? These were the kind of questions that people when doing assembly lines were asking. The difference is that the assembly line is much more distributed and is not happening in necessarily in a chronological fashion. But I think that the vocabulary still applies and allows us to think about this phenomena with this organizational heritage, so to speak.
I want to follow up on that because, and connecting it to some of the things that Tom mentioned in part one, is that arrow going to Southwest, where the way work is managed can be done mainly by planning. Because when you stabilize things, make them predictable, you just have to put things in place up front and then it happens. and as kind of the ideal, perhaps was driving that way of organizing. And what you see in, you know, the trends towards more open models of organizing, open models of doing work, is that, you know, they all talk about flexibility. They all talk about innovation and the way just-in-time, real-time adjustments in work. What I feel like is that this model towards more open models of organizing actually is a tendency where the arrow goes northeast, where companies have realized, you know, going southwest is not always the way to go. It leads to rigidity and fixed and, you know, doing the stuff you do. But if you want to stay competitive and innovative, and perhaps if you want to stay flexible to adjust to changes in the environment, we also have to have northeast. And for that, we shouldn't always rely on what's in there. We also should reach out to what is outside.
I wonder if this is related to the, we kind of glossed over that as well, the three functional tasks, or the three functional task areas that Perot identifies. And I found it interesting that he focuses, in order to explain the task structure, he only focuses on the technical control and support of production and the supervision of production. And he leaves out design, planning, and marketing. And so for me, what you're saying is interesting, because then you might consider that you can have different types of structure for different types of types of tasks. So having an organization that does very routine work, but you're also interested in innovating. So then you have kind of different, you play around with the structure and you have things that might allow you to do that at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. And what I think is what we all realize when reading Perot is that, you know, taking the organization as an entity and saying it has one form and in one direction is like, you know, we completely let go of that. An innovation department needs to have a completely different structure and you know, a form than, for instance, a production site.
So some of that has been exactly analyzed by contingency, at least this contingency, but of course, a lot later, right? This interdepartmental variation, even Lawrence and Lorsch was trying to get at that, you know, discussed that in the podcast, right? So there is exactly this. And I think, as I was saying in the first part, Perot is very insightful in trying to think, all right, in terms of the different areas and the different of tasks across the organization, right? I was going to do bad cop, however, now, because I feel that what happened is that while the rhetoric of innovation and organic has just been, you know, almost become an end in itself, organizations have created more elaborate ways to organize for that. Meaning that there is not just one way to make plans. There's not just one way to formalize. That, you know, the point exactly, if you think of the word that Perot was describing, is one of Taylorism. But Lean has showed us that you can be extremely structured and extremely innovative and flexible. People that study COVID are showing that it is the structure in hospitals and having clear hierarchy commands and relations and policies in place to react to emergencies are fundamental to what we have been witnessing. You know, so in a way, what is, I think, interesting as well, and it always happened, the phenomenon in itself has moved on, right? From the word Perot describing, that was more of this black and white, perhaps, division. The capacity of managers, of people within organizations to create new ways to organize that are able to accomplish some of these goals as being more flexible, being innovative, so on, but creating instruments that are more formal in nature, right? Well, human ingenuity is endless. And I think that's exactly what we have seen. So just to go back to the case of aerospace that he puts there, just very organic, so on. Yes, in a way, aerospace work is still very complex and there is a lot of uncertainty. But at the same time, from stage gate models to all sort of interdependent matrices and, you know, you name it, boundary, formal boundary roles. And we discussed in the post in the podcast, yes, some of these are emergent, some of these are pointed, and it's important to understand how this happens. But again, people have been endlessly, continuously, in a creative way, produced ways to organize that in a way we are always playing catch up, right? Because the reality of organizations is one in which these are the concrete challenges people are facing, and therefore they're always coming up with ways in which to deal with them. And I think that's an important insight we should remember.
Right, and I think that this what you highlight is a lot of how he differentiates. You know, that says that the organization, the way that it behaves, is so much different, because I can think of organizations where they are organized on paper one way, like a routinized type of an organization, but they behave like a craft brewery. The way that the organization does its technical work, its supervisory work, or whatever, it's done by the people to change the nature or the character of their work from one form to another, even though the input and the output looks identical. I really see a lot more broadly the way to think about how you actually use the model, because, you know, if you're not careful, you could look at the examples that he gave in, say, the perceived nature of the technology, the work being done, and, you know, the think about the aerospace, the heavy machinery or whatever, and think that, okay, specific type of organization means that it is most likely or automatically to be in one of these quadrants, you know, ipso facto. So then what we do is we got to step back from that and say, all right, so if we do in fact have a social structure that operates a little bit differently than the prototype, then there is something important to be understood there. And this also gets into what we were talking about earlier in this part about when you have an incredible external stimulus or an internal stimulus, you're in a traditional old school manufacturing organization that desperately needs to innovate. And so we're going to create a component that's going to try to put it separate, make it behave like it's innovating. But then what's the organization's culture going to do? That is either going to end up with a clash with the rest of the organization, or it's going to try to take on the characteristics of the rest of the organization, and you won't actually gain innovation. And if we want people to be innovative, we get innovative people in there who know how to innovate, who know what the flexible polycentralized model looks like, introduce that behavior is another way.
I mean, basically what you say is what we have come to learn, that the enactment matters, right? That's exactly what a lot of past 20 years of research in org theory have shown, that it's not the feature of the work, it's the work in itself that is accomplished, that we should pay attention to. And of course, that we have learned to appreciate and understand how it changes, recreates all kinds of potential probabilistic arrangements. But of course, those get actualized in the work.
Perhaps a final note on technology is in place. This is more like, you know, some free thinking. But when we look at technology as technology, what we see is the way work gets done is increasingly, you know, technology mediated, happening in networked settings that cross departments, cross organizations, cross communities, you know, looking at the people that are needed for the work at hand rather than, you know, who you have available within your particular team. And what we see is that increasingly the way work is controlled and coordinated, that's encoded, inscribed into those technologies. And so we go from a human way of managing work to a technology-mediated or augmented way, automated way. You know, I don't want to use the AI hype here, but you know what I'm trying to target at. A lot of people are afraid of what this means for work. A lot of people are concerned. Like, who defines those rules? And what values go into those rules? More importantly, I think a question is, like, how adjustable are the rules? Because what you see when you look at, you know, let's take the production floor. You talk to each other, you know, you've always did this step in a production process in this way. And you found out, hey, perhaps we can do it other. You bring in an engineer, you do a little study and, you know, you implement it. It's the human interactions and you know who to speak with to realize some change. But what if, you know, the other people on the other side of the world and the company that builds the technology through which the work process is being shaped is in China or in India? How then do we make sure that the way work gets done and the way it is structured and is controlled and coordinated is still something we are happy about, we feel comfortable with, and it's actually serving the purpose that it's supposed to serve? That's where I feel like, you know, attending to the way technology is shaping work and what the right technologies are is an important reminder, perhaps, here of Perot and his fellows.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.